Well, hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and I've got a guest with me today, Matt Dickinson. Hi, Matt. How are you?
Yeah, good morning, John. Yeah, very well, thank you.
Great. Thanks for coming on the show. Lovely to have you. Now, I don't really know where to start talking about you because you're a prolific writer. You're a mountaineer. You're a lecturer. And at least you were until recently a filmmaker. Well, before lockdown, what were you doing?
Before lockdown came along and turned the world upside down, I was mostly working really as a lecturer at this point. So a writer and lecturer. So the books I'm writing at the moment are mostly for younger readers. For example, I wrote a trilogy called The Everest Files, which follows the adventures of a young climber on Everest. And so I get invited to go and see schools and to talk to schools about the inspiration for my books, talk about Everest, talk about the expeditions I've been on and so on. So before lockdown came and turned everything virtual, I was pretty well permanently on the road doing international school visits. I did 8 long haul journeys to China and Hong Kong and schools in Singapore, international schools in Guangzhou and Beijing and Shanghai and Kuala Lumpur and all over the world. But now, of course, it's all ground to a halt. And that seems to be for the moment completely and utterly over.
Right. All right. Much to the relief of the ozone layer, I think.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. I mean, I get quite bad hay fever every year, John, and it can be quite debilitating. And this year has been my best year ever. And I'm convinced it's because of the lack of pollutants in the air.
Found an upside to what is pretty much down. And I understand, you know, you talk quite a lot about Everest and your adventures on that mountain. Well, what kind of drew you towards Everest at the outset?
Right. So obviously, when I grew up as a sort of keen mountain trekker and, you know, just a person who was keen on mountains, really, most of my early experiences in the UK were trekking around the Peak District up on Kinder Scout and, journeys up to Scotland. And when I was at university, we went up and did quite a lot of Scottish mountaineering and so on. But Everest was always a source of fascination, of course, for anyone keen on mountains. I've always been a very keen reader of mountain books, and so I was very much, you know, immersed in the Boningtons and Scotts and Taskers the mountain literature was always fascinating to me with Everest, but I never dreamed I'd have an opportunity to go there until I got invited to go with Brian Blessed, the actor, to make a film with him. So my first Everest experience came, I was working as a mountain filmmaker, and I got invited to go to Everest, very fortunately, by Channel 4 and National Geographic TV, and off we went with Mr. Blessed to make an ascent of the North Face.
Yeah, right. Brian Blessed probably isn't one of the best mountaineers in the world, but I suspect he's the loudest.
Well, that is absolutely true. He's an amazing character and a wonderful character. Has become something of a friend. And, he's still a very strong man. I think a lot of people don't know that in his youth, you know, he was a sort of, national class wrestler. And, you know, he's a really strong guy with a lot of determination and a fantastic mountain attitude. He's very patient, which is, you know, anyone who goes on those big mountains, you know that patience is actually one of the most important things you can have. And Brian is very patient, very chilled. So, and he loves the mountain. He knows the mountain. He had a fascinating relationship with it. And so Brian, you know, and I think if he'd had a chance to go to Everest in, let's say, his 30s, I think he would have summited because he got above 8,000 meters, at the age of 60.
It's an achievement that in itself, isn't it, really?
Oh, totally. Absolutely. I mean, anybody who's been to that sort of altitude will know that, you know, to hit 8,000 meters, you know, I mean, at that point, I believe it was an altitude record for a man of his age, you know.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Didn't realize that. And was he a fairly accomplished mountaineer then before he went to Everest?
Well, he had climbed Aconcagua, which, as you know, is a sort of quite a stern test of altitude itself, of being nearly 7,000 meters high. Right. So he had climbed Aconcagua. He had summited Aconcagua, which is a sort of, you know, pretty much, you know, a badge of honor on the way to Everest. So he had done that, and then when he went to Everest, he surprised everybody by how well he did, and he actually went on three expeditions, and ours was the third and final one of his Everest expeditions, and he got to 7,600 meters.
Wow, it's quite impressive, really. I don't know how old Brian Blessed is now. I'm not too sure. He seems to have been around forever.
he's probably 80 plus, 81, 82, something like that.
He doesn't look that, does he? So.
No. I mean, the thing about Brian is he's a remarkable person. He's a, you know, astonishing person in many, many ways.
Yeah. But you yourself summited as part of that expedition. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So I hired Alan Hinks, who I'm sure you know, as my sort of high altitude camera operator. And when Brian turned back, Alan and I decided to carry on together. And we went up to the summit with three of our Sherpa team and managed to summit on the north side, which was an extraordinary opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Everest has become a fairly controversial place, because in many ways it seems to me to display, I suppose, the best of mankind. It displays courage, determination, and our desire to achieve, literally, I suppose, higher goals. But also there are the downside of that, really, is the commercialization of Everest. People talking about the amount of litter that's up there, people talking about queuing. Well, what are your feelings about the way Everest has developed, really?
Right. Well, my feelings are that it's changed enormously in the last 25 years. You know, if you go back to, the 1970s, 1980s, and through really to the early 1990s, Everest was the preserve of this sort of super elite, wasn't it? I mean, you had to be Chris Bonington or a Doug Scott or a Joe Tasker or Pete Boardman to stand a chance of going on an Everest expedition. So. Yeah.
It's interesting you mentioned those names. I mean, it's I think mountaineering has changed in a way, in that you're talking about the people like Chris Bonington were leading mountaineers, but they were household names at that time.
Yeah.
Whereas I think it's changed very much, because today the average man in the street would be hard pushed to name a leading mountaineer.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. I mean, it was a different thing. There were fewer people doing it, and they were writing genuinely best-selling books about their exploits, you know, and so there was an awareness of those climbers. But, you know, really the commercial climbing didn't come in until the 1990s on Everest. But, of course, you know, the difference between, a proper mountaineering expedition and a commercial expedition is that a proper mountaineering expedition will almost certainly be trying a new route, as, you know, all of Bonington's expeditions will have done. And, whereas commercial expedition is really, it is about ticking off the summit as safely and effectively as you can. And that comes at a cost, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, we've all seen these images of literally crocodiles and massive queues going up Everest. Is that something that you've seen and experienced yourself?
So I've been back to Everest in the last couple of years. I was there in 2016 with Jagged Globe's expedition as a writer in residence at base camp, which was a great experience on the south side. And then I went back the following year, invited by the Gurkha Regiment to join their expedition and write about that as well. So I've had a couple of opportunities to go back to Everest in recent years. And yes, the sheer, you know, explosion of numbers is something to behold. There's well over 1,000 people, possibly even 1,500 people at base camp on the southern side these days during the season. And that's a lot of people. So you do inevitably get bottlenecks. You know, I've found myself queuing at various stages through the ice fall, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, when you've got people crossing ladders, it can get very, very cold. That's obviously dangerous. But the images that come from the summit ridge on those crowded summit days from the south, they are just terrifying. I mean, the thought of being on that ridge, my goodness. I mean, the cold, you know, the wind factor, the chill factor up there is off the scale. I mean, you can get hypothermia in well under half an hour, 45 minutes, as you know. And
especially if you're not moving.
Yeah, well, that's it. You're stranded. I mean, that happened to me on Aconcagua, on the final ridge on Aconcagua. Got stuck in a situation of, you know, of being unable to move, and I became hypothermic very, very quickly, and was very fortunate that I'm just had some hot fluid to restore me. But on Everest, you know, you wouldn't have that. You'd be stuck in a situation where your body would be going down. You would be going down very quickly.
I wonder where these people come from. Who are these people? I mean, obviously there are people clearly who have both the time and the money and the desire to spend a lot of money to get up Everest. Who are these sort of people mainly then?
Right. Okay. So I think, you know, when you look at there's two sides of the story. I mean, there are people who are, you know, who are sort of just very wealthy individuals who've got these desires. You know, like, you know, I've been out there on expeditions which you know, they are, you know, financiers, city people who probably get a £50,000 bonus each year. You know, beyond the imagination of everyone else. But these people are. No, absolutely. I mean, these people are living in a different zone. So they can send off a check and off they go to Everest. And you know, that's one type of person. But then you do get others who save, who get sponsors, who are not naturally wealthy people. I mean, it's probably half and half. And then the other thing, which is the most reassuring part of it in a way, is that at least two thirds or possibly even three quarters of the people that who are attempting to summit from, you know, in an average year, they are climbers from countries like Malaysia or Iran or, you know, Albania. I mean, for example, I became very friendly with a couple of climbers from Croatia, a couple of other climbers from, you know, so there are climbers from all over the world. And of course, those are not naturally for the most wealthy people. They're people who've got national expeditions together to go and do this great goal. So that still exists.
It brings people together in some ways then, doesn't it, from what you're saying? Because it sounds an incredibly international place.
Yeah, it totally does bring people together. I mean, the amount of collaboration on the south side these days is pretty slick. And, you know, you can actually get, and I have seen, a team from Iran, you know, socializing and talking about sharing the load of rope setting and building camps with a team from Israel, you know, and that would never happen in any other format. So the international flavor of Basecamp is really impressive. And for the most part, those teams get on. It's a sort of mini United Nations. I mean, the teams get on really, really well because they do have this shared objective. And, you know, that's a side of Everest that doesn't really get much reporting. You know, it brings people together.
I wrote and performed a one-man play at the Fringe.
Yeah.
To much approbation, really.
Yeah, I saw that and knew and I had researched it in the past because I also took an Everest play to the Fringe.
Three
years ago, yeah, called a play called Everest Calling, which was performed by Glen Ullmann College. So we must be two of the only people in the universe who've ever tried to put on a stage production which is set on Everest. So share that dubious accolade.
Exactly. But I did see it. Presumably, I don't know if you saw that fantastic play, Touching the Void.
Yeah.
Of Joe Simpson's book. I thought that was an amazing production. Brilliant.
Yeah, it was very clever, wasn't it? Yeah, I went to the theatre to see that, and I was very impressed with it. You know, it did an almost impossible task
Mountaineering
alive, you know.
That's exactly right, because one of the great problems I had in writing about George Mallory was, you know, just how do you recreate the atmosphere and the sheer spectacle of a mountain on stage, and it's almost impossible. I think Touching the Void got about as close as you can probably get to that, you know.
It definitely did.
Yeah, I mean, what really strikes me about what we're talking about today about the pressures on Everest, when you go back to George Mallory's time, how different that would be, and what the incredible challenge that actually mountaineers faced around then compared to what exists now.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, having Sherpa support is a massive game changer. It really is, and you know, we had an assisted ascent. We had Sherpa support every single inch of the way, all the way to the summit, and we could never have made it without them. We definitely could not. And that is an important part of the story now, because, you know, by far the majority of the commercial expeditions, they have, you know, very high ratios of Sherpa, high altitude guides and porters that they throw at the mountain, and that's one of the reasons why they're successful. But in Mallory's day, it was very unusual for the for the Sherpas to go much higher than, say, you know, the North Col or a little bit higher. Most of the higher camps, it really was the climbers themselves who were building those and going for the summit from there.
Well, that's right. I mean, from my understanding, from reading about Mallory, in fact, the local people weren't really mountaineers at all. Their culture was not that you went into these high places, because obviously, you know, why would you? You go up there, it's cold and it's scary and you might get killed, so why would you go there?
The
arrival of Europeans at that time, that changed their culture to see, I suppose, a commercial opportunity in mountains like that.
Yeah, absolutely. That again has, if you actually look at, for example, the Khumbu region around Everest, I mean, my goodness, you know, the economic changes that have happened there. It's one of the richest mountain communities on the planet.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, and the reason is that, you know, you've got this, or had until the coronavirus has obviously stopped trekking and climbing in Nepal as well.
Yes.
You know, you had, I don't know how many people a month, probably in the peak period, maybe 10,000, 15,000 people coming through the mountains on their trek to base camp.
Incredible. I mean, how do you feel about that in terms of, do you think that demeans Everest? Because obviously, you know, all mountaineers see mountains as something very special in our lives, I guess, and a great, incredible natural phenomena, you know, an encounter with nature. How do you feel? What do you think about what's happened to places, Everest and places like Everest?
Right, I think Everest is a special case, isn't it? You know, there are mountains which are special cases. Mont Blanc would be one. Denali is another. By dint of the fact that they are the highest in that region, yeah, they become a target. And I think inevitably that changes the chemistry of that mountain forever. Once it's realised that it's the highest, and it becomes a special goal. And the more people that do it, the more its reputation spreads. And that's the situation with Everest, and that will not change.
No.
You know, it's always going to be a mountain that will attract a lot of attention, a lot of controversy. But the truth is, I mean, what anyone who rubs their noses into mountains knows, there's an awful lot of them out there. And, you know, if you don't want to go and climb Everest, then go and find something else. It's you know, and have a, you know, probably, well, you know, you could probably draw a circle 20 miles around Everest and you know, there'd be a wealth of 7,000 meter mountains there, even a few 8,000 meter mountains where you could go and have an almost solitary experience and not see a single other soul.
Yes.
So, you know, Everest is a special case. It'll always get more traffic and there'll always be controversies about the mountain. And my feeling is that will not change.
Okay. And you've written extensively about Everest. Well, what was your first book?
The Death Zone was the first one.
And how long ago was it that you wrote that?
My first published book was called Long Distance Walks in North Africa. There's a book off your own heart.
Well-known bestseller.
Absolutely. I think we sold about 13 copies. In fact, the press, Crowood Press, actually... So I created this thing, you know, great sort of, I put a lot of effort into it, let's put it that way. You know, there were treks in the High Atlas Mountains, in the Anti Atlas, the Hoggar Mountains, climbing Mount Cameroon. You know, I was really into my African climbing, and not climbing, but trekking, you know.
Yeah.
And So I created this book, and almost as I was sending off the final draft and all the photos, the publishers came back to me and said, "Oh, we're actually, you know, effectively going bust." And so there's two choices here. Either we're not going to publish your book, or we'll publish it, but we can't pay you anything, you know.
Right. Okay.
So thanks for that. So I mean, they're only going to pay me, I think, you know, ridiculously £500 or something. Long distance walks in North Africa. You can still find it sort of, you know, sitting in a forlorn pile in hay, in, you know, secondhand and antiquarian booksellers in hay, you know.
Amazing. But more recently, you've been writing fiction, and more importantly, fiction for young people.
Yeah. So I'm a father of five, and one of the great pleasures of being a parent is to watch your children getting into reading, which I've always been a massive reader myself. And so from time to time, you know, as my children were growing up and I was buying books for them at various stages of their lives, I thought, oh, I'd really like to have a try at writing some fiction for younger readers. And about 8 to 10 years ago, when I kind of felt in the mood for a bit of a change, as you can probably see, I do like to reinvent myself from time to time.
Yeah.
Quite a good thing to do. I thought, I'll have a go at writing a book for, you know, as they call young adult readers, YA. So I wrote a series called The Everest Files, which is about a 16-year-old Sherpa boy who gets an opportunity to work on Everest and to go to Everest. And he needs to earn $10,000 to buy himself out of a marriage pact that he doesn't want. And because he's fallen in love with a local girl, and he goes off to Everest, and all sorts of, you know, really bad things happen to him. So it's a story of coming of age, of redemption, of the clash of cultures on Everest, really. So I wrote that series, and then Vertebrate, which we all know and love as you know, unarguably the world's leading publisher of mountain non-fiction and fiction at the moment. John Barton really liked it. He thought, let's have a go. So that was actually, I think it was the first fiction that Vertebrate had printed. And it's been very successful. I think we've gone into six reprints on the first of the trilogy.
Well, what is a young adult? Can you define that for us? What's the age?
The definition would be, you know, educationally would be sort of year seven. So first year of secondary school up to year nine, year 10, something like that. The type of kid that would enjoy the Hunger Games or the Maze Runner the Alex Rider series. It's not quite teen, but it's sort of, you know, it's heading in that direction.
And what are the particular challenges, do you think, for writing for that age group?
The challenges are massive, as they are for writing for any age group, because the attention span of the average sort of 11 or 12 year old reader is like the attention span of a gnat. I mean, they, you know, if you haven't got them in the first 15 seconds, that's it. It's over. So they're, you know, getting a young person to put down their iPad, put down their phone, pick up a book is actually really, really difficult. Yeah. And so you have to grab them quickly. It has to be fast moving, and it has to be promoted to them in a way which is acceptable to them. And that's why I go to the schools and I do most of my promotion and get most of my sales by going to schools and talking about the inspiration behind my books.
Right. And I would imagine that you know, we talked about the Fringe earlier. One of the things that I found I got out of the Fringe was that I hadn't, at the time I performed Mallory, I hadn't really written any books. But I got to know my audience really well, and I think that really helped when I started writing books, because I was writing for the kind of people who come to see Mallory, and I talk to them. And do you think that helps, you know, with your writing, that you obviously have quite a strong connection with your readership?
It's fundamental, isn't it? You have to know and be connected to your readers. If you can't make that connection, you've kind of failed before you started, haven't you?
Yes.
So I think the key thing for writing for younger people is you have to you have to make sure that that it's not in any sense patronizing. You need to actually write it as if they are an adult. You can't write it as if they are a child.
Yes. Yeah.
That's very, very important. But also, you need to remember that you've got to keep the pace going, you know, faster than it would be probably for adult fiction, and you've got to keep the imaginative twists going. So I try to make my stories very unpredictable, and I found that the more unpredictable the stories I write, the more people like them.
Oh, right. Make things unpredictable. That's a really good piece of advice for any writer, I think.
Oh, totally. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, if you can, work out your plot, write down your plot points, and then go through it and change every single one of them so that you couldn't have seen them coming.
Yes, I think that's a really good piece of advice. I remember that myself, you know.
Yeah.
And well, obviously, as you said at the outset, really, we're kind of in suspended animation right now, and we don't know what's going to happen with schools and things in the future. What do you think you'll be doing after this? What's your next step, do you think?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question, isn't it? And I think this lockdown is very serious. It's extremely serious from a health point of view, but it's also extremely serious from an economic point of view. And I've got no idea right now if my business, which is basically being paid to go to schools all around the world doing lecturing as a visiting author, I've got no idea if that business will kick back into creation again, because I've got schools cancelling deep into the autumn at the moment. I've got cancellations deep into October, November, and schools saying we've got no idea if we're going to have any money or what's going to happen, or if we're going to be, you know, our budgets might be completely cut.
Exactly. Yeah.
No one's got any idea. It's a situation which is like all bets are off for everybody at the moment. It's incredible.
It is. I think, well, the only thing you can possibly do is write something, I think.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I've been doing some, teaching myself some illustrating as well, which has been really interesting.
Okay.
Yeah, it's been really interesting. So I've been trying to learn some new skills.
As a writer, and one of the few professions in a way that's been able to keep going during the virus, because people have still been buying books, fortunately.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, it went through a very sticky point where Amazon stopped actually delivering books, which is obviously, you know, really, really, really fundamentally a bit of bad news for everybody. But yeah, people have been, I think, adults particularly have been continuing to buy books. I'm not so sure that children necessarily, because children mostly, I mean, if I look at my readership is predominantly given the books either by an adult or recommended it by a teacher. Yeah. They get a recommendation from a school librarian. Now, that is probably 90% of the pathways that puts my books into young readers' hands. And so at the current moment, that none of that is happening. Absolutely none. So the problem is, you know, how are young readers going to find your books? That's really the difficult thing.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you've written for young people about Everest. And do you think that will inspire some of them to go on to be mountaineers and to enjoy the kind of outdoors in the way that we've done?
Yeah, it certainly has. I've been doing the school presentations for long enough now that, a lot of my schools are repeat business. So I've got quite a lot of schools who take me back every year. And sometimes it's quite interesting. You get a, you know, like school librarian will turn around, and I might, you know, I can remember I was at Oakham School, and I've been there every year for the last, you know, 8 years or something. And the librarian said to me, he says, you know, one of the lads at our school, you know, went on, he's now gone through university and he's now working as a mountain guide. And she said, I remember the impact of your Everest books on this guy. And I'm absolutely sure that was a part of it. And it was really interesting and quite inspiring. And you feel, well, you've made a positive difference.
Yeah. You've obviously inspired a lot of young people to get out and enjoy the outdoors, which is a great thing to do.
I hope so, yeah.
It really is. Well, Matt, thanks very much for talking to me. It's been fascinating to talk, and I'm sure you'll be back out there at some point and driving our young people to the mountains.
I hope so, John. Yeah, have you got another play in mind? Are you going back to the Fringe at any point?
No, I think my days as an actor are probably over, really. And that's probably not a bad thing, you know. I think I'll leave that to Mr. Blessed. I think he's probably a much better actor than I am. Okay, Matt, thanks very much for talking to you, and cheers, all the best.
All the best. Stay safe. Bye now. Bye.
Bye, Ed.